All right. Well, we've been in our study looking at the Bible, an overview in 40 points, and thus our opening slide reminds us. Today's lesson is going to be on Samuel. Samuel is point number 15 out of the 40 points. You see there he's a man of transition. He will be the bridge that transition us from the time of the judges to the time of the kings. Well, here's a slide that reminds us of the first two major sections in our Bible overview. The first 6 points, the beginnings of all kinds of things. The beginnings of God's creation, the fall of man, and the growth of sin in the world. Also the establishment of the nations. We have establishment of the languages after the Tower of Babel. And then we have the beginnings of the nation of Israel with the founding fathers of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then Joseph, and their time of growth as a nation incubated in the country of Egypt over a 430-year period, coming out under the leadership of Moses. So those are our first 12 points. Of course, Moses brings them into the promised land almost, but because of his sin, he doesn't go in himself. But under his successor, Joshua, leads them into the promised land. We start having the conquering of the promised land and then the dividing up of the land amongst the 12 tribes of Israel. And then we have the time of the judges where we see that Israel had a cycle of sin that they just kept repeating. And during this time when they would be judged by God for their sin, God would raise up a judge to lead them. And not just lead them to victory over the enemies that God had used to judge them, but after the victory was done, the judge would remain as a political leader, leading them in various ways. But then often Israelites returned to their sin after the judge died. And so we come to that 15th point on the slide there, Samuel, a man of transition. And again, he's going to transition, as you can see on the slide, between the judges, point 14, and then point 16. If you already know who Saul is, you know that he's the first king of Israel. And so Samuel will bridge the gap between the two. We'll go to our next slide. And again, I know this is something we looked at last week, and the words on this are kind of small, so don't know if how well people can read it, but if you're looking at the very top row, in that top row are a lot of the judges, and I'll use a laser pointer for those in the room. Those online can't see this, but there's Samuel. Samuel is right below the top row, and his name falls underneath Samson, and it overlaps and goes underneath Saul. And so he's the last of the judges, and we'll read about that this morning. So when we pick up the book of 1 Samuel, so we finished with the book of Joshua, then we went into the book of Judges. Then there's the book of Ruth, and we're not touching on the book of Ruth. And that's, again, we're doing an overview here. The book of Ruth is kind of a side story, but it is critical to us understanding the history of the children of Israel. And by the way, we haven't spent a lot of time recently on kind of seeing how the Bible is organized in its books. But as would not be surprising to you, the books we've been in are books of history. And of course, we're doing a lot of history of Israel, but we have a lot of lessons we learn in that as well. But we're not covering all of them. So we're passing over the book of Ruth. We're looking in the books of 1 Samuel and continuing on from there. 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel take us from the time of Samuel into Saul and King David and the beginnings of the monarchy. And then 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles are during this time period. And those books are, you know, the events of the kings and things that they did, especially as the name Chronicles implies. It's a chronicle or like a journal of the actions of the kings. And so, all right, well, let's go ahead and begin looking in the book of 1 Samuel. and we'll begin in chapter 1. And when we look at 1 Samuel chapter 1, verses 1 to 2, these verses introduce to us the names of several people that are part of the narrative that we have here in the scriptures. Okay, it introduces a man named Elkanah. He's from the tribe of Ephraim, and he has two wives. One wife is named Hannah, the other one is Peninnah. Now, Hannah doesn't have any children, but Elkanah's other wife, Peninnah, does have children, and she has quite a few children. Okay? And so then, verse 3 in this chapter 1 mentions that Elkanah went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. Okay, so now we're also introduced to Eli and his two sons, and we're told that they are priests of the Lord. So you, I'm sure, will recall that the priests were from the tribe of Levi, and they're descendants of Aaron. And so not just anyone could be a priest, but Eli would have been a Levite, and he was the priest. Now it says there that they went to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Well, at this time, there was no temple. Most of us, if we think of worship in Israel, we're probably going to think of Jerusalem primarily. We're going to be thinking of the temple. Well, the temple had not been built yet, and perhaps you are aware already that the temple gets built during the time of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. Well, that's going to come later, so there is no temple yet. Well, when the Israelites arrived in the land of Canaan under the leadership of Joshua, we read in Joshua chapter 18, verse 1, again, so this is, you know, quite a bit before where we're at in the time of Elkanah and his wives and Eli, says this, "And the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle of the congregation there." Okay. So this is the location where the tabernacle has been set up. The tabernacle was the kind of the temporary mobile temple of their day. It was a tent structure. We have some pretty good descriptions of this in the writings of Moses, describing everything from the materials that the tent was made out of to the posts that would hold it up and what they were made out of. So we have quite a bit of detail on that, including its size. Well, this would have been the location of the Ark of the Covenant, which also was made during that time period. So under Moses and Moses's leadership, God directed them to make a tabernacle, a temporary religious structure, a temporary temple, and also directed the making of the Ark of the Covenant. And the Ark of the Covenant is going to play prominently in our narrative today. When we think about the Ark of the Covenant, what is it? Well, we know what it is physically. It was a wooden box overlaid with gold, had a lid on top. It had on top of the lid two angels that had their wings outstretched towards each other. And then we know that there were rings on the corners of it on the sides, and you could slide poles through those rings and you could carry it. Well, the Ark of the Covenant was more than just a box. It was something that symbolized, at least as far as the mercy seat goes, it was a location where it symbolized God coming down to man and meeting with them. It's the place where God's presence rested, especially once a year on the Day of Atonement. We also read that at times the Shekinah glory of God would come into the tabernacle and would shine and become apparent. There were other times when God's presence was clearly known to Israel, such as the thunderings and rumblings on the top of Mount Sinai when Moses was up there having God deliver to him the Ten Commandments. So this box often represented the presence of the Lord, and And we're going to see today in our narrative, I think, what are sometimes some misunderstandings about the Ark of the Covenant. Well, again, the Ark of the Covenant is in Shiloh. The tabernacle is in Shiloh, and this is where the religious worship was taking. That wasn't the only place. The city of Bethel was another place where religious worship was happening. But the location of Shiloh is in the tribe of Ephraim. So it's no wonder that Elkanah, who's from the tribe of Ephraim, would go to Shiloh to worship. I mean, that was nearby. There were other locations where sometimes the Israelites went to go take take their sacrifices there so that the priests could offer those sacrifices for them. And so remember that we're at a time when sacrifices take place. We don't need to do this nowadays because Jesus has already been the once-for-all sacrifice, and there's not a need to sacrifice animals over and over again for the sins of the people. Okay, Jesus has been the sacrifice for the sins of the people. So we look to Jesus for our forgiveness of sins. He died in our place. And that's what a sacrifice was. It was a substitutionary sacrifice. You don't have to die for your sins. You have a sacrifice that dies in your place. Well, we understand from scriptures that the blood of bulls and goats never could take away the sins of the people. It was just a picture of what Jesus would someday do. But out of trust in God, faith in Him, that He would someday send that Messiah to be the sacrifice, the people, out of trust in God and reverence for Him and obedience to what God asked them to do, would sacrifice animals as a picture of what Jesus would someday do. And so Elkanah, being a man of faith, a Jehovah worshiper, unlike some people in Israel who would stray and worship other gods, wanting to honor God, came to Shiloh, and he would have brought his sacrifice. He would have brought animals with him. Of course, they're not sacrifices yet, but they're going to be offered for the sacrifice. Of course, the Old Testament law has a lot to say about what was an acceptable sacrifice, and so he would have brought that the types of animals that would have qualified for that we won't go into right now. So Shiloh, by the way, stays a leading center, you might say a leading place of worship for Israel for over 300 years. I think it's estimated to be about 369 years of Israel's history where Shiloh was a place of worship for them. Not until the time of King David does Jerusalem become the place. Partly because, as we might recall from our recent study with Gideon, how that we referenced when we were looking at Gideon, this one location where we looked at in the future, David eventually makes a sacrifice to the Lord there, and he buys a plot of land. And the Bible ties that land to the location where the temple will be built by Solomon. And that, of course, is in the Jerusalem area. But at the time when David bought that piece of land, it was controlled by a Jebusite king. Well, remember that Israel never fully conquered the promised land and drove out the inhabitants like they were supposed to. Partly, they didn't do it because they just didn't follow through. But also, we saw as they had sin involved, God withdrew his blessing on them and says that he did not drive out the people before them. So God basically refused to drive out all the inhabitants and left them there as thorn in the side of the Israelites. But during the time of David, David was able to conquer the city of Jerusalem and gain control, and he made it his capital city. So Jerusalem was not under the control of Israelites for their early history. And so, again, we come to the time of, if we look at David, we go back in time to the time of Eli, and we find that Elkanah comes to Shiloh, and, of course, Eli would have been ministering here as the priest. I don't see anywhere, at least I didn't come across it, that the term high priest was used, but I believe that's what he was was the high priest at this time, at least it would seem to make sense to me. But and he had his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, that were also ministering as priests. Now, I use the word ministering loosely with Hophni and Phinehas. Of course, the word minister carries the idea of ministering to the needs of the people you're serving. And as we're going to see, Hophni and Phinehas do anything but that. Rather, in their own minds, they probably minister to themselves. Okay, well, then we'll come back to that and see more about that. Now, you don't see much about the city of Shiloh at a later time. We're not really told a lot of details about what happens to the city and the tabernacle. We do read this in Jeremiah chapter 7. Now, of course, Jeremiah comes after the time of King David. And it says this in Jeremiah 7, verse 1. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, "Stand in the gate of the Lord's house." Okay, now, that would have been the temple at Jerusalem, because Jeremiah ministers after the time of Solomon. So go stand in the gate of the Lord's house, the temple at Jerusalem. And this is instructions to the prophet Jeremiah. And God says, proclaim there this word. So Jeremiah, here's what you're going to stand in front of the temple in Jerusalem and say the following. Here's what he's to say. "But go ye now unto my place, which was in Shiloh, at where I set my name at the first." Okay, so another, he's telling people, hey guys, go down to Shiloh, and I want you to check out that. Remember Shiloh? The place where I first set up the worship in Israel, you know, where the tabernacle was at. Okay, "and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel." And then he goes on to say, "because of your wickedness," verse 14, "therefore will I do unto this house," speaking of the temple in Jerusalem, "the same thing as I have done to Shiloh. And I will cast you out of my sight as I have cast out all your brethren, even the whole seed of Ephraim." Because Ephraim's the tribe where the tabernacle was located in Shiloh. And so God warns them, "I'm going to destroy the temple because of your sins." Well, we know historically the temple did get destroyed. Not during the days of Jeremiah, but he forecast this or prophesied the eventual destruction of the temple. We know the final destruction was in the year AD 70 by the Romans. And there were other times where there was some partial destruction, but the AD 70 was the complete destruction. So what we learn in Jeremiah is that God destroyed the tabernacle and that location of Shiloh. And why? Because of the sins of the people. And so we see that, of course, as a pattern in our scriptures, that God reveals that when we obey him, he blesses, and when we disobey him, he doesn't bless. Now, with Israel, he's doing this on a national level, and they, of course, have a special relationship with God as no other nation has had. At this time, Israel was a theocracy. God was their king. Theocracy means rule by God. Theo meaning God, and ocracy having to do with rule. And so he had a special relationship with Israel. I can't say that everything that was his relationship with Israel would apply to the United States. But I think there's still some principles there that apply. We're not a theocracy. We don't have that special relationship Israel did, but still, as a nation, you know, if we were to honor God, God honors that. It's just a general principle. I think it also applies to us individually. We honor the Lord, and he blesses. Now, the one thing that's also true, though, is we see that the people who honor God on an individual level sometimes are affected by what the national level is doing. So those who were Jehovah worshipers and who honored God were dragged right along with all the others into the rough times that go on. And so that sometimes happens. But God blesses even during those times and takes care of his own. Even if we undergo hardships, we can still see the Lord work. Okay, so it's just a general principle that's there. All right, so we're back to 1 Samuel chapter 1. And so we have Elkanah down in Shiloh, and verse 4 says, when the time was that Elkanah offered, he would do this once a year, he gave to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her children, portions. But unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, for he loved Hannah. And so, and doesn't comment what his relationship was with Peninnah, but I think it kind of implies that Hannah was his favorite wife. We're going to get into polygamy and stuff. We get from Scripture that this is not the model, the ideal model for a marriage. But the Bible tells us this, quote, "At the times of this ignorance, God winked at, but now commands all men everywhere to repent." And sometimes God allowed for things that were not the ideal. He winked at it. You know, sometimes people not having the full revelation of Scripture and did things that weren't that great. And Jesus was confronted on this at times with teachings on marriage, divorce and remarriage, multiple wives. And God, and Jesus touches on what the ideal is, which was given back at in the book of Genesis. But remember, the book of Genesis wasn't written starting on day one of creation. It came later. And again, at the times of this ignorance, God often winked at it. And he made allowances for some of these things, but they're not the ideal. But we're not going to spend time talking about that a lot this morning. But we do read in verse 5, again, I think probably a favorite wife here, Hannah, he gave a worthy portion. He treated her extra special. And it does say in verse 5, but the Lord had shut up her womb. So Hannah was not able to have children. And this illustrates, though, that the Lord is involved in things like this. And so the Lord guides. We understand the sovereignty of God. We understand that God is overseeing things. Now, not that we go through our lives in kind of a robotic fashion where God just, you know, makes us do everything and we have no part in it, but still, he oversees things. And so here she's not able to have children, but God's behind this. And so the Lord is often behind life events. Her adversary, verse 6, also provoked her sore. Great sore is greatly. Her adversary, that's her, whatever you want to call her relationship with the other wife. Her adversary is Peninnah. Not enemy as in, like, adversary like you would, you're worried about Peninnah trying to kill her. They're not physically going into battle, but provoked her sore. It was very great. Why? Verse 6, for to make her fret. Just trying to make her life miserable. What did she use to do that? Because the Lord had shut up her womb. So she just really gave Hannah a hard time day in, day out, making her feel bad that, you know, I have children and you don't. And who knows what all goes behind Peninnah's thinking, we're not told. You know, maybe perhaps there was a jealousy there with her husband, I don't know. Maybe she just has, you know, a spirit and attitude about her where she's this type of person, I don't know. But we know that things were really hard for her. And verse 7 tells us, and as he did so year by year, as Elkanah would go year by year to offer this, so she provoked her. So this was just over and over, year in, year out. And therefore, verse 7, Hannah wept and did not eat. So especially at this time of going down, when Hannah would be treated extra well by Elkanah, Peninnah would try to make her pay for that. And Elkanah tries to cheer her up in verse 8. And he says, am not I better to thee than 10 sons? And but this doesn't cheer her up. And so Hannah's heart aches for a child. And so in verse 9, one of the times when she's down there, and she has, says there, she rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. Eli the priest sat upon a seat by the post of the temple of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept sore. And she vowed a vow and said, okay, well, let me mention here, before I say what she vowed, verse 13, how she was speaking. She spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli thought she had been drunken. So he sees this lady over there, and she's just sitting there praying, but her mouth is moving, but she's not making any sounds. And so, well, I'm kind of imagining it must have been a time when maybe drunkenness was not all that uncommon. I mean, wouldn't have been my first thought that you see someone standing there and just, you know, talking to themselves, mouth moving, that they're drunk. I don't know. Might be reading between the lines too much. But what does she vow in verse 11? O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaiden and remember me and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child, a little boy, then I will give him unto you all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head, meaning it's going to be a Nazarite. Okay, and a special vow of devotion to the Lord, and one way symbolized would be not the cutting of the hair, much like was true of Samson. And it came to pass, verse 12, as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli saw her doing that, and that's when he made his comments. And he says in verse 14, you know, how long are you going to be drunk? She says, I'm not drunk, and tells Eli a little bit about what she had just been praying. And verse 17, Eli said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And so we see then the Lord is going to grant this, and we read that in verse 19, and the Lord remembered her. So in verse 21, her husband Elkanah knew her. She it's not verse 21. Well, one of the verses. But we see in verse 21, Elkanah is going to go back another year, sacrifice. She says, I'm not going to go with you until the child be weaned. And so she conceives, she has a child, and she keeps him until he is 5 years old. And at that point, then she's going to bring him back to the temple. And so she does bring him back, verse 25, brought the child to Eli, and reminds him of the prayer that she had prayed. And she says in verse 28, therefore also I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to the Lord. And he worshipped the Lord there. Okay, and so little Samuel at 5 years old is going to live at the tabernacle and live with Eli and serve the Lord. You know, this is a special, unusual circumstance. Of course, we ought not to enter into vows lightly. Okay, but the Lord's behind this and the Lord's directing in this. And even things like the shutting up of the womb, the Lord was in that. The Lord directed in that, and as the Lord does. And sometimes he does things in ways that would not be what we would think. And here he directs through a lady who cannot have children, directs her to pray, and directs through that prayer a little boy to be born and a little boy to be dedicated to the Lord. And as part of her prayer and a condition, said, if you'll do this for me, I'll do this. She keeps that promise, and he directs a little boy named Samuel, who's going to be a prophet and is going to be a judge in Israel. All right, so as we continue looking at Eli, we'll look a little bit at his failure as a priest. God says to Eli I didn't put the chapter down here. I believe it's chapter 1, verse 27 and following. Maybe perhaps someone in the room, just chapter 1, verse 27, start off, and there came a man of God unto Eli. Okay, so then it's chapter 2, verse 27. That's what I couldn't remember, chapter 1 or chapter 2. Okay, so it's chapter 2, verse 27. I forgot to write the chapter number in my notes. I just have the verse number. Okay, so chapter 2, verse 27. So there came a man of God unto Eli and said unto Eli, thus saith the Lord, Did I plainly appear unto the house of thy father when they were in Egypt in Pharaoh's house? Well, he did, to Aaron, and specifically gave instructions that the priests were to come from the tribe of Levi. That's what it's referring to. And verse 28, did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest and to offer upon my altar to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me? And did I give, the ephod, of course, was part of the high priest garment that he wore on his chest. And did I give unto the house of thy fathers all the offerings made by fire of the children of Israel? So the Levites were given this special privilege and responsibility of conducting and overseeing the worship of Israel, including the system of sacrifices. Verse 29, okay, to Eli, wherefore kick ye at my sacrifice and at mine offering, which I have commanded in my habitation. Now, when I read that, it evokes in my mind or brings to my mind a similar image that's discussed elsewhere, such as with the Apostle Paul, with the animal kicking against the pricks. Now, I imagine that's what it's referencing. Although sometimes when we kick at something, I mean, you can kick at things you don't like, right? You can go around kicking a dog, for example. You're not doing that because you love the dog. Something mean going on there. But it's definitely this idea that there's lack of respect. Now, with the Apostle Paul, when he kicked against the pricks, like you're plowing a field, the image was an ox plowing the field, and they would put little pricks behind it. So if the ox decided it didn't like this, what it had going on behind it, it would kick against that. It was a way of controlling the animal and making it not want to do things like that. You don't kick against a prick that you get poked. Okay. Well, the main point is this. He's saying to Eli, you've not been respecting the office. You've been kicking at my sacrifices and my offerings, okay, which I have commanded in my habitation. Okay, well, how is he doing this? Now, the man Eli, I think, had a certain amount of respect for the priesthood, but not complete respect. We see that in the next phrase. And honorest thy sons, this is verse 29, above me. There was a major problem. He did have a certain amount of honor for God, but he honored his sons more than God. Okay. And it gives us a little bit more detail there. To make yourselves fat with the chiefest of all the offerings of Israel, my people. Now, I don't think Eli was completely exempt from falling into this sin. We do read later that literally Eli was a heavy-set man, at least at the end of his life. So this man often ate well and ate plenty. Well, what we find out is happening for sure with his sons, and likely at least with Eli in part, is that when they were ministering, they were also often very concerned with their own financial well-being and profiting personally from the ministry of the priesthood. And so Eli, I think, was not guiltless in this, but also the more egregious problem was what his sons were doing. And he was guilty in allowing this. He oversaw all this, and he allowed it, and he did it knowingly. Verse 34 tells us, and this shall be a sign unto thee, that thou shalt come upon thy two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas. In one day they shall die, both of them. And I will raise me up a faithful priest that shall do according to that which is in mine heart and in my mind. And so that's also another way of describing Eli. Eli did not always do what God wanted him to do. He did not always fully do according to what was in God's mind and what was in God's heart. And so there's lessons for us here. Of course, none of us are priests, but the lessons here is that God honors and blesses those that honor and bless him. And so when we have partial obedience, as was the case of Eli, partial obedience means partial disobedience. And some of the things that he allowed were really, really bad. We'll continue reading out of chapter 2 here in a moment. But again, God's blessing on him was removed, and Eli's sons are going to be killed. We'll see on the same day Eli also dies, and the Lord judges him for this. Okay. Well, if I put up our next point on the slide, you might see is also failure as a priest, but failure as a parent. So let's read a little bit more about his sons. So in chapter 2, verse 12, now the sons of Eli were sons of Belial. That is just, you know, worthless in character, is what that is referencing. They knew not the Lord. Wow. Okay. They're priests. They don't know the Lord. Now, a little side note, that happens. So let's not be naive. Someone calls themselves a pastor does not mean they're a Christian. And so there are many false prophets, many false priests, many false pastors. So let's not be naive about this. Let's not just go with surface impressions because someone sounds nice. I don't know how these guys normally appeared, because I think some, I know from the scriptures, some false prophets, false priests, false religious leaders, they come in sheep's clothing as wolves. Okay? Well, sometimes they can appear godly, but it's just appearances. By their fruits ye shall know them, the scriptures say. Well, what are the fruits of these two men, Hophni and Phinehas? Well, verse 13, the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant came while the flesh was in seething with a flesh hook of three teeth in his hand, and he struck it into the pan or the kettle or the cauldron or pot, all that the flesh hook brought out. Brought up, the priest took for himself. Now recognize this, that the way that the system was set up, the Levites had no inheritance themselves. They didn't have their own land. They were supported by the system that was in place. In some senses, it's a little bit this way, not quite, but a little bit this way with, you know, those who are in full-time Christian service. Like, our pastor in our church does not have a job outside of being a pastor. Now, there are some churches where the pastor, sometimes they use the word bivocational, where the pastor has a side job because the church can't afford to pay the pastor enough to live off of. So I think there's, you know, something there that's, you know, biblical to those who are in the ministry to be supporting them. And in large part, tithes and offerings that we give to church are to support that. And so here during the time of the Levitical priesthood, that this is what the priests live off. Now, not just Eli and his two sons, but all the priests that were involved in this. And it wasn't just three guys here. There were a lot of Levites, oftentimes on rotational duties, as we see, for example, later with Elizabeth's son, Elizabeth's husband, John, her husband, who's the father of John the Baptist, is serving in the temple. He's on a rotation there when he does serve. Someone in the room, remember his name? Zacharias, that sounds right. Yeah, Zacharias. But he's on rotation in the temple, and that would happen with the Levites. But when, you know, they're on rotation and working and stuff, they got to be supported. So they had this system. When the animal came and was sacrificed and these were burnt offerings, of course, you throw something on the fire and it's starting to cook. That's what happens. Yeah, right. We do that, right? You barbecue lately? Okay. Throw a hook up in there and pull, and whatever came off is what they got, and they got that for food. And God allowed for that, but in a sense, it was by faith. Yeah, I read, I forget if it was an autobiography or a biography of George Mueller. It was one or the other. And remember, he wanted to live by faith. They actually had in their church something that we now have. We didn't used to have this. COVID, we've kind of set this up. That's that offering box in the back wall in the lobby. And he had something like that in his church. And he purposed that he was not going to tell the people in his congregation when he had a need, that he was just going to take it to the Lord and pray to the Lord to meet it and wait and see the Lord lay that on the hearts of someone to give towards that need. And sometimes he got discouraged. Sometimes he'd go to that box in the back of the church. Remember one time he opened it up and he just had this kind of thought, which is natural for us as humans. He thought to himself, is there nothing here for George Mueller? But he did see the Lord meet his needs, even though at times he wasn't sure how, if it was going to happen or how. Well, this is what happened during this time. They were letting the Lord meet their needs. You didn't know what was going to come up with that hook. Well, what happened here? Verse 15, also before they burnt the fat, the priest's servants came and said to the man that sacrificed, give flesh to roast for the priest, for he will not have sodden flesh of thee but raw. So they started to change that and said, forget that. We want, before you even bring the animal up to the altar, we're going to slice off some really nice steaks for ourselves. So they started doing that, and they were dishonored the system that was in place. And verse 16 continues talking about that. And some people would protest, and they said unto a man that would do that, nay, but thou shalt give it me now, and if not, I will take it by force. So they did more than just ask for it. We're not asking, we're telling, and we're going to take it by force if we have to. Okay, so that says verse 17, wherefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord. The men abhorred the offering of the Lord. They had no respect for it, and therefore they had no respect for God. Okay, now we also read in verse 22, let me also make sure this is from this passage. Does the word verse 22 start with the word now? Now, Eli? Okay, good. To make sure I've got that right. Now I'm a little tentative here. Again, worried if I, because I'm jumping some verses, make sure I didn't jump a chapter. But now Eli was very old and heard all that his sons did unto all Israel, and how that and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door. So now they're also having sexual relations with the people that are coming to worship. Now I don't know what all transpired for this to happen. So I don't know. You know, the Bible doesn't give details here whether this was forced on them, whether it was just pressure on them, or whether these were also not, you know, women that didn't have hearts to do right, that were willing in it. Doesn't matter. The point is, think about this. This is supposed to be God's worship, and this is what's going on with the priests that are there. And Eli says in verse 24, this is not a good thing I hear of you. So Eli doesn't approve of this at all, and he's not partaking in these what they're doing. But we hear at the end of verse 25, notwithstanding, his sons hearken not unto the voice of the father, because the Lord would slay them. Because Eli says, you're going to get, God's going to bring this down upon you. And they don't care. They don't have respect for God. And so this is the condition of the priesthood during the time of Eli. Okay, so then we'll get back to Samuel now, back to chapter 1, and read a little bit more about Samuel. And coming back, I'll go to his mother here on the next point on the slide. Okay, so we've already read how she has her prayer. God gives her Samuel, and Samuel is delivered to the house of Eli and is going to grow up in the house. And she says in verse 28, and I think again this is chapter 1, therefore also I have lent him to the Lord, as long as he liveth he shall be lent to the Lord. And so in chapter 3, we read that in verse 1, the child Samuel ministered unto the Lord before Eli, and the word of the Lord was precious in those days. There was no open vision. You know, things are precious to us when they're rare, such as the how much you and I would value gold versus just a plain old granite rock. Things that are common everywhere, not as precious, things that are rare, become more precious to us. They're harder to get and are more scarce. Well, the word of the Lord became precious in those days because it really wasn't there much. And the reason it wasn't there much in part was because of the sins of the priesthood. And so in verse 2, and it came to pass at that time when Eli was laid down in his place and his eyes began to wax dim that he could not see. So when Eli's getting old, and he's an older man, and ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. You know, so it's a low period here. God's blessing is not there, but it tells us that when Samuel was laid down to sleep, verse 3, that the Lord called Samuel. And so now we're going to have, you know, a time. This is a man who God's going to reveal his word to and is going to work through. Now, Samuel is not a Levite, so Samuel never is a priest. He doesn't take Eli's place as a priest, but he is a prophet, and he is also a judge, or will be. Not at this point. He's still a young boy at this time. And so God says to calls out to Samuel, and Samuel says, "Here am I." Okay, but he doesn't realize who's talking to him. So he hears a voice call his name, and he's like, "Yeah, yes, must be Eli." Tells us in verse 5, he runs down to Eli and says, "Here I am, you called me." And he's like, "I didn't call you." And he tells him to go lay back down. And verse 6, the Lord calls again. Samuel hops up out of his bed and runs down to Eli and says, "Here am I, for thou didst call me." And he answered, "I called not, my son, lie down again." And it tells us, verse 7, Samuel didn't know that it was the Lord. And then in verse 8, the Lord called Samuel again the third time, and he rose and went to Eli and said, "Here am I, for thou didst call me." And then Eli perceived that the Lord was the one who was calling him. And so he's told Samuel, "Go back and lie down, and it shall be if he call that thou shalt say, 'Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth.'" And so Samuel then obeyed that, and the Lord gave him a message. And that's in verse 11. He says, "Behold, I will do a thing in Israel at which both the ears of everyone that heareth it shall tingle." Yeah, it's going to be like news that everyone's gone on to listen to. "In that day I will perform against Eli all things which I have spoken concerning his house." Now this had already been told Eli what was going to happen to his sons. But this is being now repeated with Samuel. "And when I begin, I will also make an end, for I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knoweth, because his sons have made themselves vile, and he restrained them not. And therefore I have sworn unto the house of Eli that the iniquities of Eli's house shall not be purged with sacrifice nor offering forever." It's not an end to the Levitical priesthood forever, but it's going to be a temporary end and an end to Eli's house or Eli's family. Okay, so Samuel lay until the morning, it tells us, and he's kind of afraid to tell Eli that. Who wants to deliver bad news, especially to one who's almost like his father? Okay, and so Eli, though, wants to hear it. He says, "Be sure you tell me everything. Don't hold anything back." And so he told Eli what the Lord said. In verse 18, Eli said, it is the Lord. Let him do what seemeth him good." So Eli had a certain amount of respect for the Lord. Eli knew the Lord. Again, though, he had that partial obedience and not always honoring him. And again, that's a lesson for us. Obey the Lord fully, get the Lord's blessing fully. Obey him partially, then sometimes the Lord's hand is against you. All right, well, it describes Sam, I think verse 19, as a contrast with Eli. "Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and did let none of his words fall to the ground." Samuel had full respect for the Lord and had full obedience to what God wanted him to do. It says in verse 21, "The Lord appeared again in Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of the Lord." You know, there were times in Israel's history where the Shekinah glory of God was not obvious in Israel. But now it is, during the time of Samuel. God's blessing is back, and the word of the Lord is back with them. Well, to make a long story short, because I'm out of time, we'll just kind of quickly look at some of the ministries of Samuel. And I'll have to just skim these, which will be all right. We're doing an overview. But in chapter 4, they have problems with the Philistines as a nation. the Philistines conquer them. They take the Ark of the Covenant, and this is during the Samuel's leadership. Why? Because the people had wickedness going on. Samuel tells them at one point, put away your false gods, and let's see God bless us. The people do follow his leadership as a judge. They put away their false gods, and God works through Samuel to conquer the Philistines. Now, in the meantime, the Philistines have stolen the Ark. There's a lot of bad things that happen to the Philistines with the Ark of the Covenant in their presence. Sometimes people have mistakenly look at the Ark as a source of power. No, it's God. These kind of things maybe are symbolic of his power, but it's always been God. So even when it's brought, the Philistines finally like, we got to get this out of here. They bring it back to Israel, and they implore the Israelites for ways to get rid of the curses. Now, they're ruling over Israel, at least the southern part, but they still implore them with gifts to try to get rid of the curse that's been on them. For example, one city has serious equivalent of like hemorrhoids or swellings or things down in their privates that are super bad that God just plagues them with when the Ark's in their presence. And so things like that were happening to them, where it's obvious to the Philistines that this never happened until we had the Ark here. And they identified that as the source. So really, they were dishonoring God. It's even brought back into Israel, and the same type of thing happened to the first group it was with, until finally it comes to another group of men in the city of Kirjath-Jearim, and they bring it there and think they respect it better than what the previous Israelite group had done, which, by the way, they peeked inside the Ark, so they're just like, oh, this is really cool. And they didn't have the respect for it the way they should. And they were also, many men died in that Israelite city for that. And so then it's not in this area of Shiloh for a while. 20 years it stayed in the city of Kirjath-Jearim, but the Lord blesses them there. And so moving along, though, that this is at the point when Samuel tells them, put away your false gods and God will bless. And so we see that in verse 13 of chapter 7, and the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all of the days of Samuel. And so Samuel had a ministry as a prophet, had a ministry as a judge, where God blessed. And when we look at Saul next week, we'll transition to see him going, or the leadership going from him as a judge as he's getting older and to having a king. So I'll save some of those comments for next time, and we'll go ahead.